Welcome to Nothing Ventured, a podcast exploring the stories that make the incredible world of tech and venture tick. Join me, Arish Shah, as I speak to the founders, investors, and ecosystem operators trying to make a dent in the future. Hello and welcome to Nothing Ventured. Today, I'm super pleased to have with me Cleo Sham. Cleo is currently a partner at Stride VC, a pre-seed and seed stage fund based in London and Paris that includes heavy-hitting scale-ups and unicorns such as Deliveroo, Cazoo, and Hopin. Prior to joining Stride, Cleo had been GM of Uber's Guangzhou business, then director of operations for the company's China operation all the way through to their merger with Didi Chuxing in 2016, after which she took on the same director of operations role for EMEA, leading regional ops in the 45 countries where the ride-sharing company had presence. A three times founder herself, she has personally invested as an angel and LP in over 60 startups, but is a builder at heart. Welcome to the podcast, Cleo.
Thanks for having me, Arish. Really excited to be here.
Awesome. Let's dive straight in. You were with Uber in China all the way through to their exit from the country. That must have been a super wild ride. It'd be great if you could talk us through some of the specific challenges to scaling in China beyond the obvious regulatory hurdles. And equally, would you have any advice that you would give to ventures trying to launch in China?
Well, let's start with perhaps some of the challenges that we encountered when we were scaling in China. So China, we were lucky in that it was a market with, you know, massive potential, a huge population, really high mobile penetration, and basically really great product market fit for Uber's product there at the time. And we were offering, you know, not only the black cab, like sort of more expensive product, but also a P2P product that was quite cheap. So the product was much loved and grew very, very fast. And so the challenge we had there was really about, you know, how do you scale the operations and the business when the business is growing like 10% every year, right? If we look at the sheer trips volume that we had, we went from 3,000 trips per week to 3.5 million in the space of two years. So basically a 1,000x volume growth. And so given that, you know, there's always a temptation to throw bodies at it when you're really strapped. But what I'm proud that we had done was really just keeping the bar very high on talent. We were always short of hands, but we didn't compromise on the quality. You know, we were still sticking to, you know, the golden rule of hiring slow and firing fast. And that was something that really paid off in time. And then we were also operating with, you know, a startup mentality, right? Every city was its own startup at the time. And so how do we scale to hit really big goals and with limited resources? And so on, you know, operating a marketplace, there was the driver onboarding focus all the time. How do we find more drivers and have them, you know, drive on the platform every week? From onboarding 30 a week to 20,000, how do we, you know, scale our processes and find the drivers really, right, to make that happen? And so a lot of it came from the team being very creative, leaning on partners. For example, we had a partnership with China Telecom that had a lot of underused real estate in the city. So we struck a partnership where we used their spaces for free to do physical driver onboarding. We had about 400 drivers come in every day to get onboarded. And at the end of the process, China Telecom would sell them discounted data packages, which were very popular. And so it was a win-win partnership where we gave them a lot of foot traffic and really high conversion. And at the same time, we didn't need to pay rent. And so we had more than 10 of these sites going in parallel for a while. And we were trying to onboard 10,000 drivers a week. And we were able to hit that goal because of that partnership. And similarly, on the marketing and demand side, how do you generate buzz around your brand when nobody knows you? When we first went in, the Chinese name for Uber was Youbu. So it sounded like YouTube or something like that, right? Where people were like, oh, Youku, which was a YouTube for China. They were like, oh, Youku, is that what you guys are doing? And we're like, no, it's called Uber and it's a new ride sharing service. And so nobody knew us. And so we had to be very creative around doing stunts that didn't cost very much money, leveraging partnerships with bigger brands and coming up with real hacks like partnering with a mobile game agency to create a viral game that people played and shared on their WeChat that gave out promotions, basically. And we were throwing things at the wall and seeing what sticks, basically iterating fast and testing new ideas a week and actually just executing when we came up with the idea.
For some of our listeners that may not know, so WeChat, let's call it the equivalent of Facebook, but it's really not. It's obviously a huge platform play in China that encompasses payments, social, chat, and everything else. I think it is almost the app of apps, right? It includes everything within it. And I think it's very difficult for us in the West to conceptualize how deeply integrated WeChat is in life in China, right? Just talk me through very briefly, because you mentioned there like gamification on app. that's way ahead of its time. If we think about everything that's going on right now with Web3 and so on, it sounds like almost a precursor to what we're seeing at the moment. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, I guess a lot of it's just around creativity. I guess Web3 is probably much more of a game changer. but WeChat, you were right. Like it was a combination of everyone's Facebook, everyone's business cards, and WhatsApp all in one. And so if you're able to have something go viral on WeChat, then obviously it was a very good channel to be using. Yeah, and so I guess we're chatting about experimentation, right, on the marketing side. But really what was challenging was that we were competing against DiDi, right? They were world-class in execution, looked super fast, and with insane work ethic. I think maybe just operating in the internet space in China meant that there's this frequently quoted term that's been coined recently in the industry called 996, where people would work from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., 6 days a week. And that was what we were doing, but probably more than that, where we're probably working from 8 to 1 a.m. every day because the market was moving so quickly. And at the same time, we were competing against DiDi, which also had a few billion to invest in the market and with an entirely localized team. So in that scenario, execution was the most important thing. So we had to be relentless. We had to be very decisive. So within, say, 24 hours of ideation, we would already start to execute. And so that was what was needed to keep pace and also try and gain market share at the time. And then when it came to competition, there's also the level of tactics that were employed. I guess regardless of what you think about the ethical boundaries, it's there was a full range of tactics that were used against us. Like, you know, once we gained some scale, there were ghost accounts, you know, WeChat, fake WeChat accounts that were planting fake sexual harassment cases, accusing Uber drivers of harassing the rider. And then when you investigate, it's a completely blank and fake account, but the news had already gone viral. And there's smear campaigns on the papers that were employed against us and lies that were told to the regulator. And so we had, you know, a fire pretty much every week we had to deal with while still trying to scale the business and hire the team and grow it like 10% every week. So it was just very intense. And another challenge, I think, maybe in line with what a lot of foreign or Western companies face when entering China is the localization of products. Just taking payments, for example, right? Credit cards were not the most widely used method of payment in China. Everyone had some form of mobile payment. I think WePay or Alipay were the popular ones, or it was cash. But to be honest, nobody used cash anymore in China for a long time. And so we needed to integrate with Alipay, which was additional work on the engineering side. And then due to the firewall, Google Maps clearly didn't work in China. It was always inaccurate. And we had cars that were always shifted over by a couple of blocks on the app, which was very strange. So we had to invest additional effort to integrate with Baidu. And there were definitely like communication gaps with having a headquarter in San Francisco and engineers based in San Francisco, and product and eng teams didn't always empathize. So I think for any company that's looking to go into China, having a localized product and eng team would be essential and also would enable you to iterate faster as well. And I think DiDi was able to catch up to us in their product iteration cycles. And I think eventually build something that was more localized and maybe even better than what we had because they were able to do it so quickly and such a local perspective.
I think there's a few things that you said there that resonate. So I helped launch a business in China back in 2015, and we set up a wholly foreign owned entity, a WFOE as an own. And there are all sorts of requirements around capitalization, around what sort of cash you have to retain in the business, what you can do, what you can't do. Obviously, online is hugely regulated. But the two things that really kind of stood out to me from what you were saying is one, the localization. I think just assuming that you can take tech and transplant it into China, I mean, into many countries, but certainly into China, where you have the challenges of the Great Firewall, of language, obviously, and also of the incumbent ecosystem, which is, as we said, is really prolific, I think is one thing. And the second thing is, assuming that you could have someone like me rock up in China and be able to sell in a way that a local partner or a local employee would actually be able to do. And we found this a lot, like the conversations that we would have with potential customers versus our head of business development in China would often be completely diametric in terms of both what was being said as well as the outcome. And often, I think this is something that in the West we do take for granted, is that anyone can go and sell anything to anyone else in the UK, in the US. Like if I go to the US, it would be relatively easy for me to go and potentially sell a product. But that just doesn't work in China. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would. I guess if you think about the forms of the apps or the media that everyone uses in the rest of the world, Facebook or Instagram or other things like YouTube, we're also used to, like, none of those work in China, right? So you have to learn to use a totally different set of tools, and Google didn't work either. And the way people work is also entirely different. It's very relationship driven. It's not often about being able to reference rules that are written in black and white. There's a lot of gray zones and a lot of just people worked differently. And so your network matters a lot, and being able to strike up partnerships and trust actually matters a lot. So there needs to be continuous investment in those areas. And then the government also is very influential in business, right? So just the need to immerse yourself in the local context and the culture and the environment is really critical. And I myself felt the challenge of being, relatively speaking, a foreigner who grew up in Hong Kong, who spent years going to school in the UK and the US, and having Mandarin as my second or third language, basically moving to China into a city that I never spent time in before, and having to operate in a business that's highly regulated and consumer facing was very challenging. And I think for anyone who's looking to start a business, launch a branch of your business in China, finding a local team that fits your culture, that you could trust, is critical. So it's really, you know, as you said, suboptimal to try and place an expat into the market and expect that it'll work. And basically running the market remotely also wouldn't work. And so there's no real thing as dipping your toe in the water, because if you really want a sizable business in China, you need to sort of invest properly. So whether it's a war chest, you know, to compete, or investing in infrastructure, product and engineering teams, or incorporating, you know, properly, or investing in relationships with the government or you know, the BAT, you know, Baidu, Alibaba, and Tencent, all that would probably make a huge difference in whether your business manages to scale.
Yeah, I think you have to have those boots on the ground. You have to have the guangxi, right? The relationships that you mentioned. And that trust element, I think, is one that I remember talking with my head of business development. You know, one of the things he said to me is, it doesn't matter that the contract's signed, right? That's just the first part of the dance sort of thing, right? Then there's the dinners, and there's the real kind of relationship building side of things, you know, sitting and drinking baijiu into the evening or whatever it might be, because that's the test of your sincerity, your honesty, your trustworthiness, I guess, with the partner. And these are things that I think are very subtle when you're coming at it from a Western perspective. You need that local intelligence, that local understanding, almost more so than anywhere else in China, I would say, to really be able to operate. And again, to your point, you can't dip your toes. You have to be able to go out there and almost launch a fresh business, right? It's not a subsidiary. It's not a parent subsidiary kind of relationship. You have to treat it almost as a startup and a new business in and of itself. So just moving on from China, the genesis of this podcast, and I think of so much within the entrepreneurial ecosystem, was about taking a leap of faith, right? Which is why we have the name Nothing Ventured. I'd love to understand from you the sorts of leaps of faith that you've taken throughout your journey, and what were the challenges, what were the outcomes, and what were the learnings?
Sure. Yeah. And I love the name of the podcast, by the way. It's a great name. Yeah. I guess I could share a few. First, you know, I grew up in a conservative Asian family where both my parents were professionals. So my mom had been a lawyer for over 2 decades, working for the government in Hong Kong. My dad's a doctor. Wasn't really given like many options in terms of what I could or should do. I had a lot of pressure to enter the legal profession because it was seen as a respectable, a safe path that you would expect to be able to make a decent living if you graduated with a law degree and entered that profession. So when it came to entering university, I had a 2-year long fight with my mother, her pressuring me to accept offers that I had from UK universities to go straight into studying law, to go down that path, which was what she wanted. And on the other side, I wanted to be able to define my own path. I was always curious about business, but knew nothing about it. And I just felt that there must be something else out there that I could do that would probably be more interesting and maybe more fitting for me as an individual. So I really had to put my foot down, 16 or 17 at the time, to find my own way. And it was really against my family's wishes, and I really didn't have too much support from them sort of at an emotional level. But that was really the start of my journey. And then everything went from there, right? In terms of how I made decisions really changed after that, because everything that came after was about finding my own way and figuring out what I was interested in and learning and building confidence that I was able to make some of these decisions on my own. So that was probably a first first big moment for me, a big leap of faith, I guess, and just making a bet on myself.
Which is where a lot of this comes from, right? It's about taking that punt on yourself and rising to the challenge in terms of backing yourself, I think. And it's something that I think a lot of Asian entrepreneurs, at least anecdotally, struggle with. I mean, I went through very similar sort of processes in different ways with my family. I studied languages, which was completely unheard of when I graduated 20 years ago. You know, why not lawyer? Why not doctor? Why not accountant? Although I did then qualify subsequently as an accountant. But I see it a lot more now, actually. It's interesting. A lot of my peers who went into those professions are now wondering whether that was the right thing. And they're desperate potentially to kind of move on and do something different, but feel like it's too late. I think it's wonderful that at the age of 16, 17, you're already having those conversations with your parents and able to kind of back yourself. I think a lot of people struggle with that even as they grow older.
Yeah, I guess it becomes harder as you go, right? As you get older, with opportunity cost or with obligations. I guess at that age, maybe back then, there was really nothing to lose. Just starting from scratch, you're still sort of a blank slate. So why not? And a second important moment for me was, I think, joining Uber in China. Like, as I mentioned, I had not lived in China before. I had maybe done a few consulting projects there and I'd studied Mandarin. But at the time, I came across Uber because I was really applying for the Hong Kong general manager role, which, you know, Hong Kong was my hometown. So I was like, sure, you know, this makes sense. But that role became unavailable. And the team then said, hey, you speak Chinese, like, would you like to take a crack at China? And I was naive enough to say, yeah, sure, why not? I was really just looking for a learning experience. And in the end, like, that was way more than what I had expected and a really meaningful experience personally. So going to China as pretty much the most non-local GM that was there, taking a very highly externally facing role, like facing government and press all the time and working often in the second or third language was really, really tiring. So day in, day out, you know, working in Mandarin, conversing with the press in Mandarin was actually quite tiring, but certainly like improved my language skills, but really learned a lot, right? In terms of learning about the importance of team, like building a team that I could really lean on that really mitigates my gaps, you know, 100% local team, super diverse in their skill sets and experiences. And so that as a team, they were fully complementary to each other. And we were able to try and achieve a lot of things that we needed to get done, regardless of how non-local I was as a GM. And really just understanding that I had to be very open-minded and to new ideas that the team came up with so that we could fully back and invest in those that we should try. And then physically and mentally, extremely challenging because we were fatigued most of the time, like not sleeping enough. But in the end, yeah, the outcome, as you mentioned, was good. We merged with DD for a $35 billion merger in 2 years. And it was probably the most enriching professional experience I'd had to date. So that was definitely a leap of faith that I think paid off in a lot of ways. And maybe the last one that I could share is moving from operating to investing. I think, as you mentioned, as people get older, maybe the openness to switching paths and backing yourself becomes more difficult. And having spent quite a few years in operating, there was a real opportunity cost, right? The ecosystem is very vibrant. There are lots of interesting startups out there that one can explore, like working at potentially. And I very much enjoyed operations. So there was a bit of a risk. I was always curious about investing, but what if I didn't like it? Or what if I was bad at it? A lot of the challenge to even switch into it in the first place was really focusing on the investing landscape and having conversations with funds. And that required focus and that required saying no to a lot of things, including opportunities in the operating world in order to switch. And so that was a leap of faith as well, right? And given it's such a long-term role, time will tell whether or not I'm actually good at it, and I don't know what the outcomes will be. Yeah, and then another risk you take on, and maybe we'll get into operating and investing later, is that it's you're working in a very small team environment, and team fit and culture fit is everything. So there's obviously also a potential risk that you don't find a team that you fit well with. But I guess, you know, it's all about learning in the end. And I think that's why investing is also interesting.
I think it's one of the things you said there was really interesting, right? The long-term aspect, certainly within investing, where obviously you're talking about 5, 7, 10-year outcomes, right? And one of the things I think that's really important about risk-taking is that risk-taking is not about short-term outcomes. And I think that's why many people maybe don't take risks, right? Because the payoff or the payout happens over a much longer period than most people maybe are willing to accept. And I think you have to go into it with the mindset of there is an opportunity to learn. There's an opportunity to come out with something positive. It may not work out, but equally, you've got to give it the time to actually pan out. One of the things I think that is really difficult at the moment, I see it in younger people I've worked with, my own kids maybe even, is a bit of short-termism around things. And maybe that's the nature of content and Netflix cycle and the news cycle and everything else that's going on, is this lack of ability to focus on anything that is more than 1 day, 2 days, 10 days ahead of them. I think that is probably the thing for me that really resonates, is that all of the bets that I've taken have not been short-term bets on myself. Like, the things that I've kicked off are not about instant gratification. When you launch a business, you're not going to come to an exit within 1 or 2 years. When you launch a podcast, for argument's sake, you're going to have to slog at it for months, years. If I was reading an article, like most of them, it takes like 2-3 years before you get the kind of traction and audience that people are after. And I think it's showing up and putting in the work and not necessarily having expectations. I think that's really, really awesome. And yes, I'm like, as you said, you have worn a lot of hats, right, over the last decade. So you've been a founder, you've gone from founder to COO to angel to VC. Which one is actually most in line with your personality, with you as a person? And one of the things I'm really intrigued about, because I'm very interested in investing, but I've always been an operator, is what are the lessons you had to unlearn as an operator from having been an operator as you move through to angel and then into venture?
I guess stepping back into sort of my career history, I started off in consulting and then, you know, was traded stocks for a while. Just investing came about before going into operations and then, you know, angel, and which made me think that, oh, angel investing could be interesting, because I liked investing in the past, and that was mainly in stocks, but it was angel investing felt like a good way to combine everything. And now VC, which, you know, hopefully is a good way to, again, leverage everything that was learned over time and to be able to help out and deliver value to companies that we invest. Yeah, just reflecting on what I liked and therefore why this role may or may not suit me. This, firstly, I've always loved being on teams, whether it's on a consulting team or a sports team or just an operating team, and also really enjoyed building things, which was why, you know, I was tinkering as a founder, like building things, whether it's apps, whether it's services or building teams as an operator. So being on teams, building all those things suited me well, I felt, because of my personality in that sense. I think in venture, like the team aspect really depends on which team you join. And so that was something that I was always looking for in whichever role, whether team culture or the chemistry was there and whether it was a collaborative environment. At the same time, investing was always interesting to me, initially in the stocks, but later as an angel and now as a VC, because underlying all of that was really just curiosity about learning different topics and being able to go broad in the topics that I wanted to learn, which was harder to find in operations, because in operating, I think with Uber, I was in ride sharing for 4.5 years. And as Spotify Home, I was in the prop tech space, you know, real estate rental space for 2 years. And so you go really, really deep in an area, but you don't necessarily get the breadth in topics that I sometimes craved. And so operating was great, I guess, in terms of instilling a rhythm, a weekly rhythm, and operating sort of routine and discipline and accountability, which actually is very helpful when you then take it into VC, right? For me, you know, I found VC to be a very unstructured role. You can wake up each day and have a very different day every day, depending on how you want to spend your time. And that could be great, very freeing, but also could be very unproductive if you're not careful. And so actually having that discipline and having learned that, I think was very helpful. In terms of what I don't get to do in VC is really just leading large teams, having direct ownership of business P&L that was, you know, moving every week, owning projects, or just having a real weekly operating rhythm. And so I learned a lot of those skill sets as an operator that I don't really get to directly use now. And I was warned like 1,000 times before going into venture that about the temptation of wanting to operate directly, run the companies directly as an investor. I was warned about that a lot, which was actually quite annoying. And I can't say I've been tempted to, because it just feels inappropriate to overreach. But the real skill to now learn and hone is really, how do you communicate what you know via examples, storytelling, concepts, you know, really zooming out and abstracting one level all the things that you might have learned in the past in order to make it applicable for the founder.
And it's also that difference between being an operator versus being an advisor on the board, right? I remember in my kind of earlier life, when I first transitioned from just kind of management to board and then equally to owner, those are three different hats. And the kind of incentivization for those hats is also slightly different as you move between them. And to your point, you've got to be able to distill, I guess, the breadth of your experience to be able to direct the operations, right, as it were, without actually telling them what to do, right? Or interfering, I guess, is the other word I think a lot of founders potentially use when they have maybe overly handsy investors. It is a really difficult skill to unlearn, right? Well, not skill to unlearn. It is easy to be tempted. It's difficult to kind of stand back and let them make their own mistakes. It's kind of like guiding a child, right? You've got to let them fall over and get up again, right? Otherwise, they're never going to move forward.
Exactly. And it's also, we have to understand and respect that it is the founder and their team that's really in the arena, like building and fighting the battle every day and not us. And so really, and it's very disempowering to tell people what to do, I think, versus sharing knowledge and encouraging and challenging, which I generally find to be much more of a healthy dynamic and hopefully a constructive dynamic. But, you know, what's different as an investor here is that there is an opportunity to magnify or multiply your impact if you're able to translate what you've learned or communicate the playbooks or knowledge or learnings to founders. And so the real skill then becomes, how do you do it effectively? How do you do it in a way that is relevant to them? But also, how do you communicate at the right time and in the right manner with the right tone so that founders actually accept what you're saying and actually want to listen? So there are a lot of soft skills that a leader learns in operating that actually are quite useful, like learning how to empathize with the other person, understanding their situation, reading the room, understanding the stakeholder dynamics, being situationally aware, building trust, knowing how to give feedback, and knowing how to influence those who don't directly report into you. Like, so actually, those soft skills are super important in venture as well. And they're just sort of utilized in a different way in VC than in operating.
For sure. And I think it's also, it's that old trope, how can I be helpful, right? The VC line. The reality is that venture is equal parts finance and mentoring to a certain extent. You've got to be able to, yes, identify the breakout winners, but you know, they're not winners today. They're going to be winners tomorrow. So you've got to coach them along the way. So it's equally identifying potentially the founders and the startups that have that coachability, that are open and willing to learn from the experience that you guys have and that they can draw on. And in fact, that's probably a good time to start, you know, to talk about Stride a little bit. So like, what motivated you to join Fred and the team there? It'd be great if you could talk us through a little bit about what stage and sectors Stride invests in and the sort of businesses that you guys are interested in.
Sure. I'll start with Stride. Stride is based in London, founded in 2018. We've invested a first fund in the last 3 years, and now we're investing our second fund, but both funds are focused on early stage. So primarily seed. We call it the late seed, which usually there's a product, there's a team, limited traction, but we've also invested in some pre-seeds and some Series A's. So we're able to be slightly more flexible when it comes to early stage, but generally going in early. We're, you know, based in the UK, as I said, but geographically, the UK is our core, but we're also open to investing in the rest of Europe. And in terms of themes, you know, we're sector agnostic. We'd say we're proudly non-thematic, but really just quite flexible. And we've invested in quite a few B2C companies, B2B companies, also marketplaces. For example, Cazoo was one of our investments in our first fund. So we're, you know, I'll go on to probably what motivated me to join, which would give a bit more color about Stride as well. So when I was looking at potentially joining a venture fund, what was really important to me was really the softer aspects of it. It was really the ethos, the vision, and the values, what size of team, what stage you're joining the fund at, right? So what I really felt an alignment in was the ethos of Stride and the fact that it's still a startup. So in terms of ethos, first, I felt there was a genuine intent in supporting founders. If you read what was written online, which is very consistent with what Fred, founder of Stride, talked about, you know, we really believe that the job is a privilege and that we need to earn our seat at the table to be with founders. We respect sort of the difficulty of building a company, and we understand that it's chaotic. And we generally take a craft approach to building companies. And therefore, when we invest, it's not about spraying and praying, which is, you know, investing in hundreds of companies per fund and buying options. Not saying that there's anything wrong with that approach or with funds that construct their portfolio that way, but it's just not the way we work, because we do spend a lot of time with the founders to help build companies and think about talent, think through strategy. And we think being able to do that is a privilege. And so we take a craft approach to building and investing, which, you know, resonated with me as a former operator. And so we also believe in the importance and primacy of product, the power of great design, which could really impact the user experience, which resonates with me having worked at a couple of consumer facing startups. And we're non-thematic. And so what I like about that is, you know, again, going back to being curious and liking the possibility of exploring a wide range of topics, we believe in being mentally plastic and, you know, including being open to opportunities that are non-obvious. Some of it could be quite unsexy, but we think it's important to go in with an open mind and posit ignorance and really assess opportunities openly. And maybe because we invest early stage, that's especially important. And the last part is Stride is still a startup. It has a very collaborative sort of vibe. The team was 4 people, I believe, when I joined, and we're still building. So it's just like joining a startup. startup, right? It's similar to how our founders are building startups as well, like small team. And the operator in me also likes the opportunity to be building a firm besides doing the investing work. And so I find the combination of the two very interesting. It's all in all, you know, putting all those pieces together, Stride felt like a great team to be joining and one that I was really excited to join at the time.
Yeah, I think that's awesome. I think the other thing that kind of strikes me is I've had quite a few conversations with emerging managers, and I think a lot of them are ex-operators and a lot of them want to redefine or reinvent the way venture is done and the way they build the firms that they work that they've either founded or working with. And I think that sounds incredible, because I think certainly in the UK and Europe, it's still, I mean, I talk about it as still being a little bit more akin to kind of private equity in terms of its approach as compared to, say, you know, the US VCs, which have been doing it a bit longer. And I think there's this huge cohort and breed of venture capitalists now coming up in the UK and Europe that want to bring that more innovative approach, I think, to venture. And I think that's amazing. I mean, it's certainly a fund that has punched above its weight. And I love the mission, easy to approach, but tough to get money from. I'm going to have to think twice before I approach you guys. What is the most important thing to you when you're looking at investing? Is it teams, the traction, is it the market, the tech, or is it something else altogether?
Sure. At our stage, I guess I'll talk about traction and market, because there's generally very limited traction. So that's quite a quick one. So, the product might have launched and there might be some initial customers and some insights you can glean from them and some numbers, but generally quite limited. To the extent that they're available, sure, it's a useful input, but generally not the most heavily weighted factor when we invest. A second, market size, it's important to know that there's hopefully uncapped upside in the idea, whatever we're looking at backing, but it's also easy to get market size wrong when it comes to calculating the TAM. So Uber being a very famous example, I think I read multiple times that investors had thought the black hat market in San Francisco was Uber's addressable market, which looked quite small at the time, but ultimately that wasn't. When you're starting to displace public transport and walking and other modes, that's really not the correct market size. So it's quite easy to get it wrong. So in market size, is less about the number, but more about, you know, whether or not there are waves of innovation or trends that the business can ride in order to build something that's huge. Moving on to the more important factors, you know, first of all, people, right? In the end, we're backing founders. And at early stage, you know, the idea could change. The business model could still, you know, change. And so going back to the people, are these people who can reshape their industry? Are they powerful? Are they resilient? Are they able to attract funds or stars? Do they have a huge opportunity to learn, ability to learn, and a trajectory, and also motivation to learn? And are they mentally flexible? Are they self-aware? And so those are generally qualities that I look for or we look for. And then besides that, the next most important is really the upside. Like, what is the unique insight that's driving this business? And is it valuable insight? Is it transformational, potentially defensible? Do we have what we need to believe in order for this to be big? Is there some glimmer of greatness that we're already seeing in the business that is showing us that this could really realize its potential? And sometimes founders are starting out very focused on a niche or a wedge, and maybe there's a longer term strategy to go much broader. So what is it? Do we understand the upside, and is it ideally something that's uncapped? And so those are really the main things that we look at.
Yeah, I think every time I have this conversation, it just narrows down to one thing and one thing alone, which is the people, right? And it's interesting. It's both the founder, but it's also their ability to attract incredible people around them. It's that flexibility. It's the growth mindset, coachability, and ability to learn. And I think, but it's important to also kind of think about founders need to have this real kind of dualistic nature. Yes, they need to listen and take on board advice, but not to the extent that they become sort of paralyzed in their decision making, right? Like, they need to also be quite concrete when they're making decisions. You talked about it at Uber, working off limited information, but in a fast-paced environment, you've got to make decisions within 24 hours and execute, right? Rather than waiting for maybe more data to show up, because that maybe will stop you from achieving what you're after. I think market, it's interesting. There was a tweet I saw recently. It was less about market, it was more about competition, but I think it's equally applicable to either market or competition. Like, when you see those on a pitch deck, they are engineered to give an impression of whatever the market is. And I think as founders, we need to stop maybe drinking our own Kool-Aid a little bit, but equally accept that there's probably a much bigger opportunity set out there than we're even considering, because it's all about the unknown rather than the known, I think, right? And I think one of the important things is being able to identify that there is something else beyond the obvious. And to your point, like whether it's a black cab or the medallion market in New York or whatever it is, Uber clearly proved that their market was limousines, black cabs, bikes, foot traffic, trains, transport. Like today, and I think COVID has sort of driven this a bit further, I'd said sort of pre-COVID that one of my goals in life was not to have to take the tube. COVID kind of enforced that decision upon me. And now I'll either get an Uber or a minicab or whatever it is that's available, or I'll drive in, right? Like, so that is a complete shift in the way that I even think about traveling into London, which, you know, has an incredible tube system, but, you know, has its challenges as well. So just as we kind of wrap up, it's been incredible. I'd love to get one piece of advice that you would give to would-be founders, and maybe one piece of advice for people that want to get into investment, if you can. And you know, really just would love to get your perspective on what's the really important thing to focus on.
Sure. It is a very different nature of work compared to founding or like companies or just operating in general. So I always recommend learning by doing. So just get a feel for it. Like, start by angel investing, put some of your own money at risk. It doesn't have to be a lot. Like, the check size doesn't have to be large, but just get a feel for it. Get a sense for how you make your own decisions, right? So it's really about developing your own mental framework in how you assess opportunities and companies and refining that. And so putting some money at work would generally force you to do it more rigorously than if you were paper trading. It will also enable you to sort of build relationships in the ecosystem and really learn about the space and access opportunities that you otherwise wouldn't able to do passively. And it's also a good way to find out which spaces you're naturally drawn to or not. And a lot of this investing, you know, is really about curiosity and being motivated to learn. And so it's important that you're learning about areas that you want to learn about, and not forcing yourself to study areas that you're not drawn to, because it's hard to be good at something when you're not that excited about it. And then lastly, really just meeting people who invest and understand what the day-to-day is like if you're curious about doing it full-time, right? Meet some VCs, understand the day-to-day. Not every role is perfect, so understand what's good about it, but also what's challenging. And really just think about, do you like the entirety of it, or you know, are there adjustments that you need to make in order to perform in the role and really like the work? And there's no real set way, fixed way, or right way to invest. Everyone approaches it in their own way. So a lot of it's just about finding your own style and your own way of doing it.
I think that's awesome advice, and 100% agree. I mean, I've started writing very, very small checks myself. I mean, all my money is tied up in my startups, as you would probably imagine. But there are so many ways that you can get involved now, whether that's writing those small checks directly, but equally going through syndicates, which you can now do on AngelList, or via syndicates are being run on platforms like Odin or Vauban, where you're suddenly getting access to really kind of quality deals that maybe wouldn't have come across your table, certainly at that sort of level of check in the past. So I think 100%, I love the learning by doing kind of model. That's the best way to figure out what you're good at, what you're bad at, and what you love, to your point. And I think that equally is something that's been a learning for me of late, is learning that it's okay to say no very quickly to things that you're not excited about, not because they're necessarily bad companies or they won't have potential success, but I like to think of myself as being able to add value beyond the very little money that I can put in when I do invest, and therefore it has to your point, it has to be something that I'm excited about investing in as well. Cleo, it's been absolutely amazing talking to you. Thank you so much for spending the time with us. For our listeners, where can they find you? Are you on LinkedIn? Are you on Twitter? Where's the best place for them to come looking for you?
Yeah, I think LinkedIn works well. And I'm also on Twitter. So Cleo_Sham for pretty much both of them. So yeah, welcome any outreach or messages. I'd love to stay in touch.
Amazing. Thanks, Cleo. Have a great day ahead.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Arsh. Yeah, thanks for having me again.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Ventured, an Emerge One production. Follow us on social and at nothingventured.tech to make sure you never miss another episode. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can support us by giving us 5 stars on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcast. We love to hear from our listeners to understand the topics and guests that they'd like to hear about and from most. Drop us a message via the links in the show notes, and thanks again for your support.